My name is Steve Kale, and I'm the chair and the commentator for this panel. The panel is looking at cultural exchanges between France and the Soviet Union in the 19th and 20th centuries. And our first paper, and these are out of order from what they indicated in the program. Our first paper is by Christine Grant, who's a doctoral candidate at Carnegie Mellon University, working on a dissertation entitled Model Colonies, a Transnational Study of Penitentiary Agricultural Colonies for Young Detainees in France, Russia, and the Soviet Union, 1839 to 1939. Her research interests focus on urban and rural spaces and the ways in which reformers, particularly in France and Russia, have tried to solve social problems by shaping those spaces. I'll say that she won the Midwestern Slavic Association's Graduate Essay Prize for her for a paper she gave at that conference. Okay.
Thank you very much. One Saturday in 1866, a group of Russian tourists arrived by train at the town of Tours in France's historic and picturesque Loire Valley. Fatigued of Chateau, they took their coachman's advice to visit a quite different tourist attraction, an agricultural colony for juvenile delinquents. Located a few kilometres from Tours, the colony of Maitrey had grown since its founding 26 years before to house almost 800 adolescent boys. While the enterprising coachman whiled away the time at a local restaurant, the Russians took a six-hour guided tour of the colony. The well-ordered colony seemed to them the image of what rural life should be. Quote, "One did not think of a house of correction, but it seemed as if we were standing in the square of a small hamlet." He admired the staff's, quote, "interest in the children and respect for their human dignity," unquote. The visitor saw, in fact, exactly what the colony's founders had striven to create, a substitute family for children whose birth kin had failed them, and a model community that, if replicated, could stem France's rural exodus by teaching urban adolescents to love life and labour on the land. Many foreigners visited Maitrey, the pioneer of an international movement to establish agricultural colonies for young criminals and vulnerable youth. And historians have studied the connections between reformers in France and other countries in Western Europe and North America, but no one's looked at Russia yet. And my research considers how this model traveled and was adapted to Russia, and then how it reemerged in the early Soviet Union, reimagined for a new social and political climate. My work's both transnational, because it traces connections between France and Russia, and also comparative. And for today's paper, I'm taking a comparative view of two penitentiary agricultural colonies. This one, the Maitrey colony, which was the most famous and influential of the French institutions, and the Gorky labor colony near Poltava in Soviet Ukraine, which became a model for other Soviet youth penitentiary colonies. And today I'm focusing on the role of agriculture in each of these institutions, both as a practical means of organizing and sustaining the colonies, but also its cultural significance in the work of rehabilitating marginalized and criminal children. So placing predominantly urban youths in a rural setting to rehabilitate them became the first widely adopted form of specialized treatment for young detainees. This model relied upon a set of notions about rural and urban spaces and their inhabitants that ascribed not only physical but moral benefits to rural life during a time of rapid urbanization, during the transition to industrial capitalism. The colony that established this model and which became the gold standard, both in France and abroad, was Maitrey. It was founded in 1839 by a former magistrate, Frédéric Auguste de Metz, and it took in boys who had committed crimes, most commonly theft or vagrancy, but they'd been acquitted due to their young age, according to the 1810 Penal Code. Now, prior to this, they had usually been placed in prisons where they mingled with adult criminals and were often abused or socialized to a criminal career. The two foundations of the maître system were fictive families and agricultural work. Its model spread throughout Western Europe, where nations are experiencing similar conditions of incipient industrialization and urbanization. It was also adopted in Tsarist Russia in the 1870s. Although Russia was still agrarian, similar ideas about rural virtues made the French model attractive there. And privately run penitentiary agricultural colonies operated until the revolution of 1917. In 1920, in Soviet Ukraine, as war, hunger, and displacement created thousands of orphans and abandoned children, one of these old agricultural colonies was repurposed by the new authorities to shelter these waifs, but also to develop a new system compatible with a socialist society of educating children in a collective. Colony's director, Anton Makarenko, used his experiences there to develop pedagogical theories that became the cornerstone of Soviet education and child rearing. And in 1935, he published a fictionalized account of his work in the colony. It's called Pedagogical Poem. And it became a classic of Soviet literature. In fact, its popularity has outlasted the socialist society that he was working to create. Makarenko rejected the progressive pedagogy that was then in vogue in the Soviet Union, but he created a system based on his own personal experience working in two youth institutions, first at the Gorky labor colony, his agricultural colony for young offenders, and later on at the Dzerzhinsky labor commune, which was an urban institution where homeless children worked in a state-of-the-art camera factory. For Demes at Maître, agriculture was fundamental to rehabilitating young detainees. This wasn't his original idea, although the way he implemented it was new. In the first half of the 19th century, various reformers applied the concept of an agricultural colony to their reform or utopian schemes. Political scientist Barbara Arneel has written of the process of domestic colonization. And this was where reformers in the 19th and early 20th centuries applied the labor of marginalized populations within a country to uncultivated land, thus rendering both the land and these people productive and useful to society as a whole. The catchphrase, amending the land by the man and the man by the land, summed up this transnational movement. Demes was the first in France to apply the concept of an agricultural colony to a population of juvenile criminals. And due to his prodigious talent and efforts in promoting the colony, Maître became one of the best-known examples of this principle in action. At Maître, boys, the number varied, but usually 300 to 600 of them, they lived in separate buildings in family groups of about 20, headed by an employee whose official title was father of the family. Most of the colonists were 14 to 17. They spent at least 2 years there learning to work the colony's fields. And a smaller number practiced a manual trades, such as blacksmithing or shoemaking, to provide for the colony's needs. For Demes, agriculture had first of all a physical benefit, where fresh outdoor air and vigorous exercise would strengthen weak bodies spoilt by life in unhealthy city slums or by monotonous work in cramped and stuffy factories and workshops. Quote, it is the air of the fields and not the sedentary tasks of the workshop which gives them a robust constitution, a precious gift indeed for the man who needs to work, unquote. When a government inspector in 1853 disapproved of boys being sent out to work in the fields even though they were feeling unwell, Demes disagreed. To deprive these children of distractions, of exercise and the fresh air by consigning them to our infirmary is to go against the means necessary to modify their sickly constitutions. A sentence served at Maître was not to be a temporary remedy. Demes and his supporters intended to habituate the boys to rural life so that they would choose to remain there when released. They have lived in the impure atmosphere of the big cities and the workshops, wrote one staunch supporter. Can we not, by placing them amongst the fields, make them love and taste the charms of a life more in keeping with our natural needs? Give them a trade that brings them back to agriculture and preserve them for the future from dangerous frequentations. Evidently, these reformers believed that the key beneficial effect of agriculture was its location, far from the cities, which they viewed as magnets for vice, crime, and political unrest. Colonists' agricultural labor also served a practical purpose in the colony, as they grew vegetables and corn and they raised livestock to feed themselves and to sell their surplus. In the early days, supporters hoped the colony could become self-sufficient. But for de Metz, agriculture's moral impact took precedent over its economic advantages. Quote, "The colony of Maître should not be considered as a purely agricultural establishment, but a house of correctional education, in which agriculture and rural work are applied as a powerful and effective means of moralization." End quote. Agriculture was never a sure source of either products or income for the colony. It was acutely vulnerable to price fluctuations, and it often registered losses. Agricultural labor was presented as more intellectually stimulating than factory work. Quote, "Work in the fields, by its variety, forces reflection and develops the intelligence deadened by the uniformity of the mechanical operations of the workshop." End quote. But often, rural labourers outside the colony were seen as dull, backward, and uncooperative. Quote, "They defy the examples and advice given them by men who are placed above them." End quote. Evidently, reformers did not believe work in the fields could of itself produce intelligent workers. This was only possible through the wise guidance and discipline of Maître. Fresh air, exercise, and honest toil were the colonists' reward. But de Metz never spoke of any affective benefits from contact with a natural environment, such as peace, reflection, rest, or a sense of the sublime, which we tend to associate with time in nature these days. However, one writer who visited Maître in the 1860s described a boy from a wealthy family who spent a few months living near to the colony. I'm going to read part of this quote. "The child walks in the countryside. All around him he sees labour, order, discipline, and thus learns to evaluate existence rightly. The double spectacle of calm and fertile nature and ordered and creative human activity in its turn speaks to his soul a language that it cannot help but hear. He lives in the heart of nature, in peace, truth, and labour." Thus, the working class boys of the penitentiary colony became part of the spectacle that revived in the privileged boy those nobler sentiments seen as appropriate for his class. In other words, while colonists were obliged to approach nature as producers, the upper class boys and also other benevolent visitors to the colony related to it and to those labouring in it as consumers of an uplifting spectacle. Now, despite all these loudly proclaimed benefits, some children resisted field labour. Quote, "When the weather is very cold, some regret even the central prison, where instead of working outside, exposed to all the bad weather of the season, they were confined to well-heated workshops with no other tools but a shuttle in their hands." End quote. Although such mutinous remarks as that were soon hushed by a spell in the detention cell. Parents, too, were dissatisfied with a program that robbed their sons of the opportunity to undertake apprenticeships in more lucrative industrial or artisanal trades. And by the 1880s, Maître's governors recognized the validity of this argument and expanded the industrial workshops, agreeing that for a city boy to return home with no useful trade could doom him to a life of poverty and crime. When Anton Makarenka began his work with young detainees in 1920, he approached his task with a very different ideology and worldview than de Metz and his respectable, notable supporters. A teacher and the son of a railway worker, he supported the Soviet regime. When he accepted the assignment of directing an agricultural colony for juvenile delinquents and homeless waifs, he set out to run it on socialist principles. He named it the Gorky Labour Colony, after the eminent Soviet author. In the second picture, Gorky is there in the middle with his white hat on, visiting the colony. The original colony that he took over had been founded in 1891 by a charitable society. Unlike other penitentiary agricultural colonies in Tsarist Russia, it had emulated key characteristics of the system developed at Maître, such as separate buildings for families of detainees. But despite being located in the fertile black earth region of Ukraine, the colony itself occupied a singularly inauspicious piece of land. And when Makarenka took over, attempts at cultivation met with little success. He later wrote, "The very soil on which our colony stood was unsuited to agricultural purposes. It was little better than sand, which a breath of wind sent shelving into dunes." In the first years of the Gorky colony, agriculture meant, first and foremost, a way to escape hunger. At this time, Ukraine was not entirely under Soviet control, and the Red Army was still fighting partisans. Government agencies struggled to provide the colony with the supplies it needed, and Makarenko and his charges often went hungry and in rags. Still, the detainees did not try to run away, since, as Makarenko said, there was nothing particularly attractive in the life of the streets during the year 1921. Once the Civil War ended, Makarenko managed to find ways for his colonists to get to work and bring in income. Without horses or farming equipment, they could not yet cultivate the colony's meager fields, but they did manage to acquire a smithy. Makarenko wrote, "We were thrilled by the animation which the smithy brought with it. At 8 o'clock, the cheerful ring of the anvil resounded throughout the colony. Laughter was always coming from the smithy." In Makarenko's description, it's industrial and not agricultural work that brings excitement and animation. Industrial work played an important role in Bolshevik ideology. The proletariat, urban factory workers, were the class whose temporary dictatorship would usher in a classless communist society after the revolution. Their experiences, Bolsheviks believed, made them more conscious of how the world worked and gave them the principles they needed to change it. Now, in theory, the Russian peasantry were allies, class allies of the proletariat. And the Soviet hammer and sickle proclaimed the unity of the two classes, just like this very famous statue where you see the factory worker and the collective farm worker together moving Soviet society forward. However, any peasant who could employ laborers on his land or who owned enough agricultural equipment, horses or livestock was classified a kulak, a rich peasant, and viewed with deep mistrust as a proto-capitalist exploiter. The Gorky colony's neighbors, Makarenko wrote, were kulaks, and in his book they are constantly undermining Soviet power to try to enrich themselves. As for the children themselves, Makarenko wrote, quote, "They had not the slightest awareness of belonging to any particular class. We had hardly any children of workers. The proletariat was for them something remote and unknown. While most of them harbored profound scorn for agricultural labor, or rather not so much for the labor as for the laborer's scheme of life and mentality." Makarenko recorded incidents of colonists deriding their neighbors' corrupt dealings and participating enthusiastically in raiding their stills or catching them illegally harvesting trees. But gradually, the colonists came to think of themselves as proletarian. In 1923, Makarenko and his colonists left their original premises and took over the former estate of a noble family that had fled the country. The estate was on fertile land, and after colonists completed renovations, they soon had a thriving agricultural concern with various grain crops, milk cows, and a major hog breeding business. They met their own needs, they sold the excess, they could even help the poorest local peasants by distributing free piglets. The move away from the poor quality land that the Tsarist regime had deemed appropriate for young lawbreakers to the rich, productive former noble estate made Makarenko's work highly symbolic in the new Soviet regime. Makarenko claimed that by teaching the colonists to see themselves as a collective, he had developed in them a proletarian consciousness, even as they worked in agriculture. Their success also depended on rational scientific cultivation. Makarenko hired a qualified agronomist whose methods made the colony productive and prosperous. However, once they had developed this consciousness, Makarenko wrote, they could no longer be content with the idyll of agricultural work. And indeed, Makarenko soon found a new challenge for himself and his colonists. Just outside Ukraine's then capital, Kharkiv, a former monastery had been converted into a children's home where 400 children were living in near anarchy, stealing and selling anything they could get their hands on, filthy, ragged, and idle. Makarenko offered to take over the colony, bringing his Gorky colonists with him. Impressed and intimidated by the new colonist work ethic, the neglected children integrated themselves into the collective, and together they repaired the buildings and started to farm the land. Once again, rather than clearing and colonizing uncultivated land, Makarenko's charges took over land abandoned by class enemies of the Soviet regime. In this case, they also transformed abandoned humans. Agriculture alone was not enough to satisfy nascent proletarians. They needed to be active and useful builders of socialism. But Makarenko did not stay long at this new colony. Here he quotes another colonist, saying, "Our people, the waifs, as we're called, are proletarians. It's industrial work they need. Of course, it's jolly and all that to work in the fields, but what do we get out of the fields?" And another one, "Oh, how I love work in the fields. What a pity that there's no sense in it, damn it. Wouldn't it be nice if you could work in the fields and reap and have textiles growing up, boots, fields of machines, tractors, accordions, spectacles, watches, cigarettes waving in the wind." Now, to say that there is no sense in meeting the population's most basic needs for nutrition in comparison with producing such items as accordions and cigarettes, it's a striking statement of the priority accorded to industry at this moment in Soviet history. In 1928, Stalin had launched the first five-year plan, introducing an all-out effort to turn his agrarian nation into an industrial superpower. In the face of this imperative, there was no place for 19th century notions of rural virtue. Agriculture might be sufficient to plant the seeds of a collective, but true proletarians must eventually devote themselves to industrial production. Makarenko and a group of his most trusted colonists moved in 1928 to a new labor commune in Kharkiv, run by the NKVD, the formidable state security service. Here, they learnt manufacturing skills, producing electric drills and 35mm cameras in the commune's well-equipped factory. A quick word about Makarenko's autobiography. It is a problematic source. It offers a wealth of information that archival and bureaucratic documents lack, but it wasn't published until 1935, 6 years after he left the Gorky colony. In any autobiography, the author selects certain details in order to turn the chaos of every day into a coherent story. This one was published on the eve of Stalin's Great Terror, a time when implying any critique of Communist Party policy was already extremely risky. So the views on agriculture and industry that Makarenko ascribes to his colonists and to himself in the 1920s were undoubtedly influenced by the political realities of the 1930s. By describing 1920s peasants as kulaks, who undermined Soviet rule by cooking up home-brewed vodka or mistreating their labourers, Makarenko echoed official justification of the forced collectivization of Soviet peasants in 1929 to 1930, and even of the Great Ukrainian Famine in 1932 and 33. In conclusion, then, in the 1930s, French journalists exposed serious abuses at youth penitentiaries, including Metray, which had declined steeply over the years. And leftists in France held up Soviet colonies, including Makarenko's, as a better way to help troubled youth. Metray was shut down in 1937, and by that time, Makarenko had left youth work to write full-time. Not long after that, the NKVD disbanded his labour commune so that the factory could be used by adult workers. Agriculture was central to both Metray and the Gorky colony, providing food for their tables and work for idle hands. However, in 19th century France, reformers associated farming with moral virtues, whereas for the early Soviets, only industry could develop the proletarian consciousness needed to create a socialist society. Can the Gorky colony be classified as an example of this domestic colonization that Barbara Arneil wrote about? Well, like Western colonies, it did set out to reintegrate a marginalized group into society, transforming them from parasites into useful citizens. But Makarenko and his collective did not colonize uncultivated spaces. Instead, the two properties settled by the Gorky colonists moved from serving traditional elites, the nobles and the church, to serving the proletariat, and thus becoming useful to the socialist state. And that's it. Thank you.